We're approaching not just the 11th hour, but literally the 11th month without a state budget. In the state house, Republicans and Democrats are pointing fingers at each other.
It's my impression that their attitude is to scale back and to move into the summer and to basically hold the taxpayers hostage for the remaining of this fiscal year.
That's House GOP leader Jim Durkin. Here's his opponent in the Senate, President John Cullerton, pointing the finger right back.
Hostage taking is when you don't pass an entire budget at all for two straight years in exchange for some nebulous business-friendly reform.
The big question this morning, is there a movement afoot to put a temporary budget in place? We'll bring you the latest. Also,
smart innovation is beginning to replace cheap labor as the key competitive edge.
Why some former Rust Belt towns are emerging as the next centers of innovation. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their holiday weekend. Things have been busy in the state house in Springfield. There's a new wrinkle in the budget debate this morning, hours from the latest deadline to get a spending plan in place and avoid starting a second year without a state budget. The Rauner administration has floated a stopgap proposal that would temporarily fund K through 12 schools, some social services, and prisons. A few days ago, the administration dismissed a similar idea from Democrats. We're going to learn more about all of that in a moment. In the meantime, the Senate is expected to vote today on a plan that Democrats in the House passed last week. That plan is billions of dollars in the red. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner has said he'll veto that if it makes it to his desk. Democratic Speaker Michael Madigan has said lawmakers are prepared to stay in session throughout the summer. All of this, of course, is in the context of health and social services being cut, colleges and universities laying off staff, and state parks, museums, and other agencies making cuts or shutting down. So what's next? And what's it going to take to get a budget deal? We're going to talk up to someone who's been a part of those negotiations in the past, former Governor Jim Edgar, but we wanted to start in Springfield with Brian Mackey. He covers state government and politics from WUIS and Illinois Public Radio and joins us from WUIS. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Nyla.
What's the reaction been to the Rauner administration's proposal for stopgap funding? What are you hearing this morning?
Well, it's interesting because this mirrors a proposal that Senate President Cullerton made last week. In fact, there was a leaders meeting today. The Senate president came out and said the governor told him he was prescient because he had talked about that interim budget idea last week. And so now the governor appears to be sort of embracing that idea as the clock is ticking down to the end of session and certainly the beginning of next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. He seems to not want to be the only state still in the country that not only didn't have a budget for last year, but still doesn't have a budget for next year either.
Brian, is there any sense that Governor Rauner is dropping his turnaround agenda for this temporary budget, or is it just that the urgency seems to be right now on trying to get a stopgap funding in place for everything that's not been funded so far?
Right. I wouldn't say the turnaround agenda has been dropped. However, for this particular set of funding, he is not tying that to his agenda items. There's also no new tax increases suggested here, which pretty much everybody who looks at the Illinois budget says you're going to have a combination of cuts and more taxes or fees or something, more revenue coming in to government in order to balance that. For this purpose, at least, Governor Rauner has indicated, or his budget office at least, has indicated that this is just talking about spending here. There's not any new revenue, and there are none of these, what the governor has called reforms that he says would help business and would also weaken labor unions in Illinois.
Brian, what do we know about what's in the proposal?
So there is a lot. There was a 2.5-page memo put out by the governor's budget office. We could spend the rest of the segment just reading that. I'll just try and hit some of the highlights. For the current fiscal year, the 11 months we've gone without a budget now, there's money for homeless programs, domestic violence prevention programs, sexual assault programs, state parks, things like that. we've seen agencies that provide these services, that have contracts with the state to provide these services, have in some cases been laying off staff, shutting down, reducing services. So that would try and get some money to them. It would also have money for utilities, electric bills at things like prisons, mental health centers, veterans homes. There's also apparently money in this proposal to pay for stamps for the Department of Revenue so they can actually mail things and help collect tax money for the state of Illinois.
So it sounds pretty thorough, Brian.
Yeah, it's pretty thorough. And there's also money for next year. Higher ed would get another $600 million, which is about the I don't know necessarily either. I haven't seen details about how that would be divided up among the various state universities, but that's about the amount that gave them 30% funding for last year. So definitely not full funding by any stretch of the imagination. This is basically intended to get them through the end of the year.
Through December then. Okay. After the election, which has been some question as to whether or not we would have a budget before the November election. Now, Brian, I know there was a meeting scheduled for 10 a.m. this morning. Who's in that meeting and what are they talking about?
Yeah, that's the governor and the leaders, the legislative leaders, the four tops they're known as sometimes. You have the Senate and House Republican leaders and the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, who are Democrats. So they came out of that meeting. The Democrats, as I mentioned earlier, Senator Cullerton said that the governor told him he was prescient because he had basically proposed this sort of stopgap temporary budget. He says that the Speaker and he agree that they want to send that to these working groups, these groups of legislators that have been negotiating on the governor's agenda as well as budget items. They want to negotiate on this budget, and they don't seem to be in a hurry to get that done by the end of today, which is the scheduled end of the spring legislative session. The Republican leaders came out of that meeting and called it disappointing. They say, we have this stopgap budget. It can keep aspects of government functioning, keep schools open. It could be done by midnight tonight. They say the Democrats are unwilling to do it and called that laughable.
And Speaker Madigan has basically said that this will not be approved by today's deadline. He's already said that.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. It seems like he wants, to take some time to digest this, perhaps. Who knows what sort of games. The Speaker has already announced that the House will be in session at least every Wednesday through the end of June. So whether this is just to buy time on more negotiations, I dare say I would never presume to say what is the Speaker is really thinking. But yeah, he basically said that this would not be done today.
Brian, two questions for you. Did you get the sense from the Democratic leadership that they found this proposal by Governor Rauner a surprise?
You know, that's hard to say. I don't think that anyone should be surprised by anything in state government anymore. I mean, we had our surprises, when we started going month one, month two, month three.
Now that we're in month 11, are we past the
point
of surprise?
Yeah, I just don't think you can really be surprised by anything anymore, short of, some sort of the governor or the House Speaker converting to join the other party or something like that. I wouldn't
Brian,
be surprised by
that. Given
much.
The fact that, as, Senate President Cullerton said, this was a lot of what he proposed last week, does that then, by extension, put additional pressure on Democrats to make a deal, given that this seems to be very similar language to what was proposed last week?
I think the Republicans certainly think it hopes so, or they hope that it does, I should say. And I think that probably there, in the past you have seen differences between House Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton. And so the Republicans may be saying this is a way to drive some daylight there because, they have different priorities. They have different constituencies in terms of the legislators they manage. The House Democratic Caucus tends to be a somewhat more conservative caucus, more averse to raising taxes. The Senate Democratic Caucus is a more liberal caucus and is, willing to take some more liberal votes, including raising taxes in the past. So the Republicans may be looking at this as a way to try and get the Democrats to square off against each other a little bit. And certainly by taking up a proposal that this Democratic Senate president came up with. Admittedly, he said he came up with it just in the shower before going to one of these meetings last week. So it wasn't something that seemed to be really well thought out. But yeah, it seems like they're trying to increase pressure on Democrats to do something. And the governor has made a point all year of saying schools need to open, that's where he wanted to draw a line in the sand. He did not want to see schools not opening, as he continued to press for his agenda.
That's Brian Mackey. He covers state government and politics for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, joining us from Springfield. Thanks, Brian.
Happy to be here.
You can listen to for more from the State House throughout the day and later this afternoon during All Things Considered. Joining me now on the phone is former Governor Jim Edgar. He was governor of Illinois from 1991 to 1999. Governor, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
I know now we're talking about how the conversation has shifted, at least temporarily this morning, Governor Edgar, to this idea of a stopgap measure. This would be, as Brian Mackey was just explaining to us, a short-term deal. It looks like it's buying lawmakers basically through the end of the year, through December, to find a compromise on a full budget. I wonder your opinion on stopgap measures in general.
Well, in general, they're bad. I mean, we've kind of had partial stopgap this last year. And it's just driven the state deeper into debt. And unfortunately, a lot of programs have been ignored. And so a stopgap is kind of the worst. Now, it's probably better than nothing, but it's pretty close in my estimation. I mean, the key is to have a good budget. I mean, we've gone 11 months now without it. And unfortunately, every month you go without it, it makes it that much more difficult because the state's deeper in debt. So, I don't think you need to rush into it. As was mentioned, they don't expect that'll pass today. This will not be a tough vote if this is the final thing. If the leaders agree on it, they can get a supermajority without any problems. And the fiscal year doesn't begin till July 1. I would hope maybe in the meantime, now that the governor at least has somewhat moved off his turnaround agenda, which has been the holdup on getting a budget for the last year, maybe they can begin to take his proposal of a stopgap and make it into more of a permanent budget and make it a little more responsible in the long term. Because, again, we are spending much higher rate than we're taking in revenue right now, and that's just compounding the long-term problem. Also, a lot of the solution here is one-time revenue, which means next year we're going to have to find additional revenues to make up for that one-time revenue source. So stopgap is the worst kind of budget you can have, but I can see where some people would rather have that than no budget. But it also takes the pressure off to get a real budget.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, Governor Edgar.
Schools, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go ahead. You were saying if you keep the schools open.
Well, if you open the schools, that is the biggest pressure on the legislature to get a budget. Last year, when the Democrats sent the education bill for elementary, secondary, and the governor signed it, and the courts also said you could continue to have state workers get paid without a appropriation bill, which I think shocked everyone, that pretty much took the real pressure off the legislature and the governor to sit down and finally, come up with a budget. And, the stopgap budget might get us to pass the election. I'm not sure there's any more reason to expect a budget after the election than before. The major concern is a tax increase with the election coming up, and if the governor is going to insist on the turnaround agenda before he'll go for a tax increase, I don't think the Democrats are going to go for that. So I'm not sure putting this off till after the election is going to make it any easier then than it is now.
And it sounds like you're saying that you think the stopgap funding or these are band-aids to solve that aren't really solving a very serious problem.
You're kicking the can down the road with what you're doing, and then also making it more difficult what the final real solution will be if eventually we get to that point. Now, saying that, if I was a school superintendent, I'd want to pass my bill. If I was in social services, who have really been hurt, they haven't had a lot of money, they'd want something passed. Higher education, this is far from taking care of the needs of higher education. You're going to continue to see a lot of problems. But if I was the president of the university, I'd rather have a little than nothing. So I can understand why people say, we'll take this if that's all we can get. I'm just saying long term, it's going to make it that much more difficult, I think, to finally get a meaningful budget approved and take care of the state's long term financial needs.
Well, and as you said, I think your distinction about November is an interesting one. I wanted to just ask you a little bit more about, because it sounds like you're saying that the November distinction of an election is maybe somewhat of an artificial one we're making, because there are actually very deep philosophical differences that seem like are what cannot be bridged right now, and an election won't make a difference with that.
Well, some of it's philosophical. A lot of it's just personal. I mean, you've had a lot of comments made, commercials run on TV that really made this to become much more of a bitter fight than it was a year ago. I mean, remember, a little more than a year ago, these two Democratic leaders and this Republican governor worked very quickly to come up with a revision of the 2015 budget, which I thought was extremely impressive. I had high hopes for the state. But then we got the turnaround agenda, which, you know, made it impossible, I think, for the Democrats to go along. And we've now had this stalemate that has become much more personal and much more bitter than just being a philosophical disagreement. So, you know, I heard him say last year, well, once we get past filing date, once we get past the primary, we'll get something done. We're past those, and nothing's been done, and people have just dug deeper in. So I'm not optimistic that after the election they're going to come together on this. You know, if there's not real pressure, if there's not the threat of schools are going to be closed, you know, that people, state workers are going to be let go, short of that, I'm not optimistic, I guess.
We're speaking with former Governor Jim Edgar. He's joining us from his home in Springfield. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with Governor Edgar. Governor, I'd love to kind of get your perspective on kind of behind the scenes and pulling back the curtain a little bit on negotiations. I'm hoping you can fill us in on that. If anyone has questions or comments, as always, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show what your thoughts are, if you think there will be a deal, how much Illinois needs this now. That's 21st Show on Twitter. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking with former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar about the current state budget impasse. Some word this morning from the State House that Governor Rauner has proposed a temporary budget. We're talking to him about that. We're getting your comments on this issue. Sheena says on Facebook, we're watching a political game of chicken in our state. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet to the 21st Show. You give us a call if you want to share your thoughts. 1-800-222-9455. Governor Edgar, just before the break, I was thinking about, you know, our current situation is unprecedented in so many ways, but obviously this is not the first time we've seen tough budget negotiations, including during your tenure. And I wonder if you can give us a sense of what kind of conversations are likely happening right now, or if you think they're not happening, what should be happening among the leadership?
Well, my experience was the most effective was one-on-one. You get the four leaders and the governor together. That's usually after you've already laid the groundwork and you know you might be moving toward an agreement, and then you get everybody to say it there. I don't think there's been as much one-on-one. And every governor's style is going to be different. And let me just say, the governor drives the budget negotiations. The budget comes from the governor in Illinois. And to me, it was always the number one priority. I mean, there were other things I wanted, but I wanted a budget more than anything. I wanted a balanced budget, a budget that I could do what I needed. So the governor has to take the lead, I think. And, you know, you got to set aside your personal feelings and maybe set aside certain things you would like to get, but you know, you've got to concentrate on the budget and then have some conversations, either you or a key staff person who can talk to one of the legislative leaders, particularly the other party, and try to begin to find if there's some common ground that you can find. And that takes time. And, again, there's got to be trust. That's one of the things that's very important in all this. There's got to be – you can disagree philosophically, but you have a respect or a trust for the other side. It's a lot easier to come up with some compromise. And unfortunately, I think in the last 11 months, one of the other things that's gone wrong is what trust we saw last spring when they did the revision of the 2015 budget is pretty well disappeared. And that makes it more difficult to get an agreement.
Governor Edgar, we just got this question from staff on Facebook. She was wondering, Pennsylvania faced a similar situation but was able to resolve their impasse in March. And she was wondering what complicates Illinois. Is it the personal behavior of leadership, as you're saying, a lot also about whether or not there's respect between leadership?
You know, it's hard to compare one state to another. How they do things in Pennsylvania or Indiana is completely different than how Illinois functions. And so it's a little bit of apples and oranges. And I don't know the particulars in Pennsylvania. I think what finally happened, the thing I read, the governor kind of backed off and kind of went along with the other party and agreed on to get a budget. Here you've got to – I think if you got to the budget and dealt with revenues and expenditures, you could probably get an agreement, but that's not what's been holding this up. What's been holding this up is the turnaround agenda that Governor Rauner has kind of inserted. And whether you like that or not, that is something different than usually what happened in the past. Usually we fought over the budget. We had side issues, but that didn't usually – that wasn't holding up the budget. And this is unique to have these other issues kind of be part of the budget process. And, you know, if you got to the budget, you're talking about expenditures and revenues. The tough part is the tax increase. And the Democrats, it's obvious they don't want to do that by themselves. They want the Republicans there. And the governor is using that as leverage to try to get his turnaround agenda. But as a result, we don't have a budget. And I just think that the budget is the number one priority, and that's what we ought to concentrate on. But the governor is the 800-pound gorilla in this deal. I mean,
well, and
there's
I wonder...
a lot about Speaker Madigan, but the governor kind of can set the tone to get, a budget. If he feels so strong on the turnaround agenda, and apparently he does to hold up the budget, I don't know what you change. I don't know how you change that in his thinking.
I'm wondering if, as you say that about the governor setting the tone, what we saw yesterday with several Republicans in the Chicago area defying Governor Rauner, voting and to overturn his veto on that relief mm-hmm. bill for Chicago Fire and Police pensions. Do you get the sense that among these, as you said, the leadership matters, but now we're seeing these working groups. Yesterday, we saw three Republicans saying, no, this we have to figure this out for Chicago. Do you get the sense that maybe given what's happening with a lack of action at the top leadership, that there's going to be more rank and file movement?
I'll be surprised if it's enough to resolve this issue. I mean, I think there is a lot of frustration among the rank and file. They want a budget. I mean, they're not as tied to the turnaround agenda as the governor is, but they're back home and they've got constituents, and particularly those that come from swing districts where you have all types of constituents you got to worry about. I think there's a real concern, but I haven't yet seen, you know, it'll take the leaders. The leaders are going to have to kind of, I don't think the rank and file will be enough of movement. And again, to be very truthful, the worst, a really bad thing would be for the Democrats to be able to pass a budget, even with a few Republicans helping them, and override the governor's veto, because you've got to have the governor on board to make the budget work. The governor administers the budget. There's many ways a governor, and I know I did it, you can hold up spending things. So the governor's got to be part of the process in the end. So even if the Democrats were able to pass a budget and override his veto, I think we'd still have a problem, because the governor doesn't necessarily have to spend the money. He can hold things up for months. So it's far better. In fact, I think it's the only way it's going to work is both sides are going to have to, you know, find some common ground and compromise on this.
Governor Edgar, we just have a few minutes left, but two last questions for you. Do you think enough lawmakers realize the costs of what we've suffered as a state going almost an entire year without a budget?
Well, I think a lot of them understand it, and I think they're frustrated. But again, they're sitting there, their leaders, and the governor, particularly on the Republican side, he has all that money to put in their campaigns. On the Democratic side, I think there's probably, my sense, a little more frustration on the Republican side than there is on the Democratic side, just from the rank-and-file members I talk to. Though I think both rank-and-files would like to see this thing resolved. There are many Democrats who will throw some of the turnaround agenda to the governor to give him something to save face. And then the Republicans, they would like to move on and get the budget. But I still am not convinced yet that you're going to see a revolt by the rank and file, or they're going to put enough pressure. They could, but I'll be surprised if it happens.
Well,
when you say
pressure, then I think that my final question to you is, do you think enough voters have realized the cost? Do you think enough voters are putting enough pressure?
Oh, no, I don't. I think a lot of people haven't been affected yet. Many have, and many are becoming more and more realized. But if you shut the schools down, you'd have a budget resolved in a matter of days. If you didn't have any state workers, I think that put a lot of pressure, because a lot of state services are still being provided. A lot of people who don't rely on specific grants from the state, I don't think yet have felt. I just think these guys are down there fighting, and why don't they resolve it? If you're in education, particularly higher education, if you're in social services, if you're in any program that relies on state funding, you know it. But there's a lot of people who haven't yet felt that. I think more and more every day are, but I don't think there's enough yet outcry about, get this thing resolved. And that'll have an impact if that ever does occur. And again, that's why I say if the schools didn't open in September or in August, I guess they open now in the middle of August, I think by the end of August you'd have a budget. I think then you would have enough pressure that, everybody would have to back off a little bit and find some compromise. Leverage is important in this process, and the public opinion. I just don't think they've filled it yet. Now, they're going to be out campaigning. They're very afraid about voting for a tax increase before an election. That's part of the dilemma here. But, my sense is that they're going to get an earful. But I'm still not convinced after the election that they're going to come together and resolve this if they can't now. I mean, it's going to take something other than the election, I think, to get this resolved.
It's former Governor Jim Edgar, now with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, but joining us from Springfield. Governor Edgar, thanks so much. I always appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Nice to be with you.
After several decades of a near obsession with making things as cheap as possible, the future will be focused on making things as smart as possible. That's why some of our former centers of manufacturing across the United States, what some people call the Rust Belt, still have lots of potential. That's the contention by financier Antoine Van Achtmel, the former World Bank economist, who's arguably the founding father of emerging markets investing, has turned his sights now to cities like Akron, Portland, Dresden, and Eindhoven to analyze how these cities have managed to retain a focus on innovation. It's all in his new book. It's called The Smartest Places on Earth, Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Innovation. He joins us now from Washington. Antoine, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
I wanted to start with your focus on what's so important about new manufacturing and what you call the new economy. How are you seeing technology play a role in the economy that's maybe different than it was decades ago?
Well, technology has always played an incredibly important role in the economy in this country. But there was a period that we kind of lost it when it came to innovation. Some of the government research labs had less money, and the corporate research labs were being diminished by the bean counters, as I call them, often MBA trained. And they were kind of taking down that money. And as a result, we had less innovation. And now it seems, and this is really the exciting thing, wherever you go in the country, or I should say wherever you have good research universities in the country. This innovation is coming back in spades.
How did your work in emerging markets lead you to this topic and to going to places like Akron and Portland and discovering how they are keeping their economies vibrant?
It's surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
It started actually on a trip I had to Asia. And I have to say, I nearly dropped off my chair when I was talking to people that I knew well in China, Taiwan, etc., who were complaining to me about American competition. And so I asked, is this your higher labor cost? Yeah, that played a role. Is it the shale gas that made our energy cheaper and more available? That played a role. But the real problem was they couldn't keep up with American innovation. And so I started to ask myself the question, why is that? And it is really, as you said, because for 25 years, we tried to outcompete the Chinese and others by making things as cheap as possible. But it didn't work. And we have learned now that we have to compete, and we're going to do this in the next 25 years, by making things as smart as possible. Think of things like the self-driving car or wearables that monitor your health or really interesting new drugs based on the genome research or the brain research. That is where we're going. Your father's manufacturing, I'm afraid, is not going to come back, but an entirely new form of manufacturing. And you have in Chicago, for example, this digital manufacturing lab. That is the direction of the future.
Yeah, UI Labs. Well, and as you said, so there's certain hallmarks of these places, and I thought it was interesting. You sort of lay out, there's kind of a couple key factors of places that have done this well. You've already mentioned a major research university, but there's a couple other things. What else did you find for what you call building this brain belt ecosystem?
Well, typically what it requires is that you have to have felt the threat. You know, in a place like Akron, Ohio, for example, the tire industry disappeared virtually overnight. What they kept, however, was this really world-class research on polymers. And so now they're developing a whole new series of products that put them ahead of the game again. And as a result, there are more jobs in these 1,000-plus little polymer companies than there ever were in these four big tire companies that were there. That is what makes this exciting, not just the innovation by itself, but the fact that it is actually creating jobs and that it's taking place not just in Silicon Valley or in Cambridge, but all over the country. We have identified some 35 places, two-thirds of them former Rust Belts, where this is taking place.
Well, and as you said, it's creating jobs, and I want to get into that in a minute, but does it always make sense to focus on a certain cluster? You talk about North Carolina and its work for Research Triangle and is known for life sciences. As you mentioned, Akron and polymers. Does it need to be in one cluster?
Well, what you need is, as you said, this combination. A combination, first of all, of a good research university that has world-class research. Second of all, you need to have felt the threat. Number three, as a result of feeling that threat, you have to have a willingness to work together, to collaborate, to share brain power. Number four, what you need is a connector. Someone who is able to talk to people and say, listen, it is in all of your interests to move forward and to work together. And finally, you need an infrastructure. You need, you know, cafes. You need places where people can meet informally, where they can share this brain power informally. And frankly, you need inexpensive housing. This is how Silicon Valley priced itself out of the market.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Antoine Van Akmel. He's the author of The Smartest Places on Earth, Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Innovation. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about how towns in Illinois can use this to their advantage as well. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about how to make things as smart as possible, as opposed to making things as cheap as possible, and how that helps manufacturing in centers and towns all across the Midwest, known as the Rust Belt. My guest is Antoine Van Ochtmel. He's the author of The Smartest Places on Earth, Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Innovation. And he's joining us from his office in Washington, D.C. And Antoine, I think as we've been talking about this, the interesting thing, I think what everybody is always worried about is people and jobs. And I wonder, right? So this is my question for you is, when we talk about technology and how much of it focuses on people, how much of this is about having highly educated, highly trained individuals leading these efforts?
Yeah. Let me start by saying that the anger that people in the country feel, and that I think has fed the Trump campaign, for example, to some extent the Sanders campaign, is quite understandable, because there's no question that we had huge job losses. But what people forget is that we not only had 7 million in job losses, but we have now a high-tech economy of 10 million people. I mean, you have seen it in Champaign yourself, where there's a lot of high-tech work going on. And so during the same period that we lost 7 million jobs, we created 4.4 million jobs. The problem and the anger is about the job mismatch. And as you say, yes, this new economy is good for those who are highly trained. Actually, half of the jobs in the new economy, as I call it, the digital economy, whatever you call it, are really for people with basically an excellent education. But the other half are for people with post-secondary skills, plumbers, people who can work machines, etc. And so it's literally half of those jobs. And what is also very encouraging is, and this comes from a book, not our book, but another book, The New Geography of Jobs, by Enrico Moretti. He has computed that for each high-tech job that is created, there are five other jobs that are created. That's a lot bigger than the multiplier that you have for an industrial job loss, which is 1.7. And again, half of those jobs are good jobs, half of them are less good jobs.
I wonder what we can learn. A lot of this book, you also focus on centers, how Dutch and German governments and people and companies have worked to revitalize their areas. I'm thinking of Dresden and other towns. How much, I wonder, when we're thinking about refocusing education and retraining programs, do you think there's a difference in philosophies in the way European governments fund these education and retraining programs and essentially economic development in the way that Americans do?
Absolutely. And whether it's Germany or Switzerland or Austria or Denmark or Holland, they're all very strong, led by Germany in what is called these work-study programs, where basically local governments, local companies, local trade unions all work together to create internships where people are taught post-secondary skills and where they also learn what it is like to work in a factory, and then often like this. And this has been extremely effective there as a result of everyone working together. And here, we used to have this at the beginning of the 20th century, but we have lost a lot of it. And this needs to come back, because by 2020, a little-known statistic is that we're going to have 5 million jobs. These are post-secondary jobs, post-secondary education jobs, that need to be filled, and we don't have the skills.
Well, and we don't have the skills, as you're talking about this gap. It's sort of the medium-skilled worker, right? It's someone who is helping create these smart technologies and the smart manufacturing. What do we need to do within our education system, and what did you learn on your travels? Are you seeing, for example, in Akron or in Portland or in New York, are you seeing that their local education or their K through 12 education is doing things differently to help create a next generation of workers, or is anyone doing a good job on that, on the American side?
Yeah, no, there are some places, but unfortunately too few, where the community colleges really are focused on this and where they have programs in advanced manufacturing. We have seen these programs, we described them in the book, for example, like TechSmart, or in North Carolina you have them, but you have them in a lot of different places. Unfortunately, not enough. These are the programs where the community colleges focus on training workers and doing it together with the companies. By the way, in Canada, they do this very much as well. And in Boston, they do it to some extent. But not enough. That's the problem. We need a lot more of that. And it would be good for those who have a basic education. It would be good for the country, and it would be good for innovation.
My guest is Antoine Van Achtmel. He's the author of The Smartest Places on Earth, Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Innovation. He's joining us from Washington, from his office where he's based at Garten Rothkopp. Antoine, I wanted to ask you about, as we're thinking about this in the Midwest, and we're thinking about people listening to this all over Illinois, there are a lot of towns across the state that used to have manufacturing centers,
right,
and those don't exist anymore. And one of the questions I was going to ask is, one thing that you identified in your research, everyone wants to have an Akron or a Portland and figure out ways to revitalize their economy. But one big part of that is having a big company come and relocate. What advice do you have? Is it possible to do that without a large corporate presence?
It is, but it's more difficult. The ideal is, I mean, the ideal picture is that you have a company where there were a lot of people that had actually good skills that went into a decline and is looking to find something that is interesting and new. Combine with a university and use the research from that university to work together and to create new products, often in startups. It's the combination of these three parties together with the local government that makes this possible. And it's not just theoretical. This is what you actually see happening in a lot of different places. And just in Champaign itself, you have a lot of this new high-tech industry, all or much of it related to the university.
Mm-hmm. But I think everyone these days, everyone has an incubator. Every town has a research park, right? So what really will make the difference to elevate a place that maybe has an incubator or a research university to a level of really changing the economy around that town?
I think the key is that a university develops a focus where it is truly world-class. That's what they did, for example, in Akron. And the other key is that within that community, rather than just kind of waiting for Washington to do something, which will never happen, they take the initiative to bring people together. And finally, the name of the game is always, how do you hold on to top talent? If your top talent disappears to Silicon Valley or to Cambridge or whatever, the game is still lost. You have to make things interesting for these smart young researchers to stay around and invent things there and then work with companies to make them into products.
Well, and as you think about that, I can't help think about, we've spent this hour of the show talking about the state budget impasse and how the lack of funding for major universities, for the state university systems, for the University of Illinois. And there have been a couple departures of some high level researchers at the University of Illinois in the past year. And that's not, they haven't said it's necessarily because of the state budget impasse or the lack of funding, but certainly you've heard university officials say they're worried about thinking that there isn't a level of support for state universities and research. I think that's something that's happening across the country. It's not just happening in Illinois. We're seeing less and less government funding for state universities, for these large research institutions.
Yeah.
How do we combat that?
This, I believe, maybe this is the perspective from someone who grew up not in the United States but in Europe, but who has lived here for a long time. We have a basic problem. And the problem is we want the services. We want the infrastructure. We want the good education. We want the healthcare. But we don't want to pay taxes. It doesn't work. The two have to go together. And as long as we just say we refuse to pay taxes or to tie the two together, we have a problem.
I'm curious about what advice you would have then for towns that want to create something like this. It sounds like you're saying a lot of this involves in changing an attitude about what we want to invest in terms of priorities.
The best advice I would have is kind of take a look at different groups of really smart people in your community. Try to identify a couple of people who can really bring them together, what I call a connector. And then sit down together and say, okay, what makes us special and unique? Where can we do something that is different? Where can we innovate? Where can we build on some of the old skills that we have here? And when you do that, it is surprising what you can come up with.
When you say that and you talk about connectors, I'm thinking in particular of one of the first connectors you highlighted in the book in New York. I wonder if you can explain sort of if there's personality traits of these connectors, because it's an interesting personality, because these are people who are very high achieving in their industry, whether it's engineering or other things. But then they also have kind of another aspect to their personality in terms of bringing people together.
Yeah, what's so interesting is that each of these connectors were actually very different. In Akron, it was Luis Proenza, who was the president of the university. In Albany, New York, it is also someone in the university, but who was a former militia fighter in Lebanon and a brilliant physicist. In North Carolina, it is basically someone who is an administrator. In Portland, it was Phil Knight, who started a big company for sneakers and clothing. So it can be a very different personality. What they have in common is that they have vision. They are able to have entry to people and get people together. And third of all, that they have this combination of persuasive power and willingness to continue even if things look very difficult and move forward and convince other people to do that. That's the combination that you're always looking for.
I wanted to ask you, I'm curious about how you contrasted the anger that we're seeing in this country right now and over jobs and over the jobs that have been lost, over skills that maybe don't have, we're sort of in this mismatch period, as economists would like to say, right? But how I contrast that with the tone of your book, which is so optimistic and so hopeful for American towns. And I guess I'm curious how you reconcile both of those as you've been throughout the country and traveling and been in all of these places. What kind of message do you want to share for people?
Yeah. What I've learned over the years is that when there is a turnaround, when actually new things are happening, it is often not recognized. Think, for example, of the smartphone. Who in the world would have thought that this would be of fundamental importance in our lives? It's something that kind of creeps up to you, and it's important before you even know it. Think of Google Map or Google Search. Who could do without that anymore? But we're not measuring it. So I believe that actually we are still looking in the rearview mirror and are not measuring accurately what we are achieving and thereby underestimating what we're achieving. We in Europe, they think of themselves as sometimes, you know, becoming a museum. And here we're thinking of losing against China. Whereas in fact, I believe that most of the true innovation is taking place in this country. It's taking place all over the country, not just in a few places. And that we're in fact beating the Chinese and others in innovation. And that, in the end, is the key to the future.
That's Antoine Van Ochtmel, author of The Smartest Places on Earth, Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Innovation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That does it for us today. Stay tuned throughout the day, especially during All Things Considered, for the latest on the state budget impasse. Tomorrow, we'll be bringing you reaction from social service groups, including Lutheran Social Services, and we'll speak with labor groups like AFSCME to get their take on what's going on in Springfield. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. All of our contact information is on our website. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.